Accession number 30493, reel 2.
It's a terrible time, and all we could do was get into uniform, do something about it. And millions did. A lot waited till they were called up, but the nation woke up at that point, happily. But yes, you ask to what extent that those views were shared. I say, well, a good half of, I think, of Britain knew Hitler was an evil that had to be confronted instead of appeased. So I think that was true.
What was your experience of the public morale after Dunkirk?
Well, within a month or two, I was in uniform. And so I was posted to Bulford Barracks on Salisbury Plain. And, of course, straight away, we had this First World War training. That is, fixed bayonets, charge, kill, 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 which was pretty useless at the time. And there were no guns to train on except First World War guns, you know. It was a terrible time, really, when I look back. So there wasn't much contact with the public at that for some months through this training period, which is a routine army training, utterly inadequate for what was going to face us later on. However, we were posted, well, there's this basic training, and we were posted to Nottingham. And there we were billeted in the streets, with, you know, in the civilian streets. And we were largely used to enable life to go on functioning in Nottingham. For instance, coal distribution. We had to go to the coal yards, help load coal from the trains to trucks. And we were engaged in collecting waste paper in the streets from houses. And, you know, it's a really sort of basic economics, you might say, of survival. We were used as a sort of civilian, in the civilian capacity, really, and not for exactly training for warfare. However, an important factor at that point in my life was I was generally confused politically at that time, 1941. That was a terrible year, you know, because there's nothing but bad news. The defeat everywhere throughout the world. Loss of battles, retreating, you know, losses in Singapore. Everything just seemed to disappear. The war seemed to be lost, frankly, in 1941. I mean, Hitler hadn't yet attacked Russia, so then I don't think, no, 41. Anyway, we were suddenly, we were posted to Yorkshire, and there we received £25 a gun, straight from the factory. And that was a great day. Suddenly you felt that you were a soldier proper, and you were training on these, it's a marvellous gun actually, talking technically. It's highly mobile. To become part of a team on a £25 was very satisfying, and we became really very well trained, you know. By the time we've actually fired the Malanga in Italy, we must have been the best trained for best trained soldiers in history, I think. Years and years of camp training in every conceivable environment. However, in Yorkshire in 1942, that's where we felt we were soldiers and ready to go into a war. And Churchill came up just to inspect this regiment of artillery with our spanking new guns. And he marched up between the guns in his bowler hat and waving his stick at us, I think. And we all clapped him, very unmilitary-like. But I think it was quite fondly meant, since things were so bloody bad.
What had been your family's reaction to your joining?
Family? Well, I suppose the usual family tears from Mum, you know. That's the picture throughout history, isn't it? Mothers sending their boys off to war. What I can't understand is the mothers who cheer their sons off to be slaughtered or mutilated. I can't understand any mother being behind her son going into the army. But my mother wept tears, and I think she did the right thing. I did come back, of course, happily. My father, well, he was always a bit of an enigma to me. After all, as I say, he survived the First World War, never talked about it. I never knew what went through his head, you know. That's a familiar story too, isn't it? Fathers and sons. He's just an enigma to me, I think. So I can't report. Anyway, my mum was very good at writing letters, and the letters to the soldier at the front are really vital, you know. And she kept up a good flow of letters, and I did too. That's all I can say about my parents, really.
If we go back a bit to that initial basic training.
Basic training, yes.
What do you remember of your first arriving?
I remember, let's begin. A little anecdote. I said goodbye to my mother. I went to the bus stop, and I suddenly felt a need to go back. And I went back. The front of my house was just a few yards from the bus stop. Went round back home and said, "Oh, Mum, I haven't got a handkerchief." And she got me a handkerchief, and I was able to hug her once more, you know. That sort of sums up the feeling that I was leaving one life behind and beginning another. So the journey down to Salisbury, I suppose it was, on the train, and no memory of that really. Arriving in Salisbury, I would have gone on to a little bit in a truck waiting for new arrivals, and then we'd have gone off to Bulford Barracks. What memories have I got? One important memory is after a few weeks there in the barracks, in the barrack room, I felt the need for a radio, and there wasn't one. Unlike today, where you just can't get away from radio, not morning, night and day. I wrote home. They must have posted it to me, and they sent me a very nice, I remember very well, a Ferguson portable radio, which sat very nicely over the shelf at the end of my bed. And now this is another significant thing. It used to play whatever was popular. It was left on radio, or whatever it was then, in those days. But on Saturday night, what I wanted was Saturday Night Theatre. I would switch to Saturday Night Theatre, and though it was my radio, I had to fight to keep it on theatre night, you know. In fact, I think there was one actual fist fight, if I can remember rightly, which I argued was my radio. I listened to my programme, thank you very much. But that's interesting, because it showed I had an interest in theatre then. Because my mother insisted that we listen to Saturday Night Theatre. It's a big thing on radio then. And so I got hooked on drama on the radio. Apart from that, I remember the stupidity of this bayonet practice where officers told us to shout "kill, kill, kill" while you plunge your steel into a bag representing the enemy, just as though it was World War One, because the officer class really thought it was going to be World War One all over again. I discovered that quite quickly. I thought, these men don't know what this war is about, you know, this training. And that hit home very early on, that the people at the top didn't know what they were doing. I mean, I didn't know any better, really, of course, at that point. What else do I remember training? Not very much, really. I must have got used to the food. I got used to these guys from every part of Britain. And I used to listen, hear what stories they had to tell. Then there was the endless sex talk. Now that's interesting. Sex was just a dirty topic. I mean, it was, if you talk sex, you talk dirty. It's the only way soldiers seem to be able to talk about it. And I used to hear these hair-raising stories of sexual activities, and I was still a virgin. I didn't know what. I didn't know how to measure up. What to think about this story. And I remember, this may have followed a bit later when we were in Yorkshire. I suddenly dawned on me how bloody ignorant I was about the whole subject. And, I mean, I had sexual urges like the next guy. But apart from that, I wrote to a firm that advertised the loan of books during the war, and one of them was a sexual encyclopedia. Now, at that time, there were practically no books about sex at all. You could name them on one hand or less, three fingers, I think. It was Murray Stopes' Married Love or something. Wasn't very useful, I don't think. But there was this encyclopedia which embraced everything about sex and aberrations and strange activities that were a revelation to me. But at least I dipped into that before I sent it back after. I think we were able to keep it for a month. Now, after that, I was quite well informed, you know. I remember Sergeant was instructing us on the gun one day, and he brought the word erection suddenly appeared, and of course there were giggles all round. And the sergeant said, "All right, what's all that about then? You know, who can describe what an erection is?" Absolute silence. I said, "The male organ becomes gorged with blood, Sergeant." "Oh, very good, Grace." Which was the result of my reading the sexual encyclopedia. A little digression, but quite an important one, really.
Was sex and sexual health covered at all in your...
Sorry?
Was the whole topic of sex covered at all in the training and sexual health? And
well, the army had always been afraid of sexual diseases. And I think very early on you had some sort of lecture. I don't really remember. I do know that condoms were always available to the troops. Although, you know, very often there wasn't a woman within 100 miles of me. where you were during the war's years. But the army, I don't remember, it's extraordinary, in our unit, I don't think there was one case of anybody falling sick through any sexual disease. It's an interesting subject, of course there's quite a literature about that now, sexual experiences. There's a marvellous myth that occurs in the army, you know. I'm sure you'll find this interviewing other veterans. Everybody believes that this is a universal myth in the armed forces, that the cook puts something in the tea. You must have heard this. And it's because sexual appetite just diminishes because there's no sort of sexual provocation around you. I mean, no half-naked women every day in your journals or magazines. And the women themselves are totally absent. I mean, there might be a few naffy girls you might see in the naffy. And I remember one of the most infuriating things for soldiers who go abroad is when they're on the troops. This is the Second World War anyway, I don't know what it's like today. You get on your troop ship and you're packed like sardines into this, what was once a luxury liner. I mean, if you look at a sardine can and open it and see how the sardines are all fixed, laced together, that's how we were at night, with a hammock slung over the tables you ate on. But up above, on the upper decks, there were the officers. And believe it or not, there were women up there. They were in uniform too. There was another life going on up there. And I think it took 6 weeks for us to get from Scotland to Suez. The sea was infested by U-boats. We had destroyer escorts, and we zigzagged across the ocean endlessly, evading U-boats, till we got to Cape Town. And had a week in Cape Town. That was a marvellous week, I must say. And then back on the troop ship, and up the Suez Canal, and ending up in Cairo. I lost my train of thought there.
The fact that there were women on board.
Ah, that's it, yes. No, it was the image of the privileged life of the officers up there on the upper deck. I'm sure they weren't sleeping like sardines in every night, you know. And one of them might have had a woman in bed with him too. No, I think the troops down below were very well aware of that.
What were both the barracks themselves like?
I haven't got much of a memory of that. They're just primitive, your classic barracks room. You know, I think about, what would it be, about 20 guys or 10 each side, about right. And it was, you know, you had... in each barrack room there were two heaters, two coal-fed heaters to keep them warm. It was then this parade ground drill. That's just the thing that haunts you. It dogs you throughout your army career. If an officer thinks you've got he can't find anything for you to do, he orders you out onto the parade ground, and you stamp up and down, and you wheel, and you halt, and you march, and you halt, and you march. And miles of marching, senseless marching. It's as though it's designed really to sort of crush your brain power. This will be to turn you into an automaton. That seemed to be the aim of army training. A lot of it. The officer class lacking all imagination, it seemed. As though we weren't really human beings. It's just the monstrous side of the army, you know. The fact they think your intellect's been left behind. A better army if it was better informed and better educated by the officer class. But there's this class thing in the army. It's indisputable. It's encouraged. The officer class is so set apart from the men. There's the NCOs in between who relay all the commands and the messages, and you hardly ever talk to an officer as a human being. I mean, the best officers communicated. Very few, I remember, actually communicated, and you felt you had a human being talking to you as a human being. Seldom happens in the army. Of course, I'm talking about the Second World War. Has things changed? I doubt it. Wolford Barracks, that's not much to remember, really. It's just an awful routine with a drab, lonely sort of place on Salisbury Plain somewhere.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to the military discipline?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Did you find it easy? Suddenly being bawled at, you know, day and night. I mean, an NCO seems to think the louder he shouts, the better soldier you're going to be. It doesn't really work that way. Because mostly the sergeants training were, I think some of them have been in the First World War. They're quite a different generation. We were all fresh-faced 20-year-olds, you know. And these were guys who'd been years in the army, and I suspect the older ones had actually been in the First World War, spent their lives in the army. So you just had a different kind of human being in charge of you, really. It was difficult to adjust to, I think. You just had to accept it. I don't think it's easy for anybody coming from civilian life. I think it is a shock. I mean, the army tries to put this image, utterly deceptive image of itself. I mean, after all, its job is to recruit people. So it creates an image of a life for the soldier, which is utterly and totally false. Utterly. And it's only when you get in to uniform that the harsh realities began to bite home. You're away from family, loved ones, wife if you're married, children if you've got them. It's a terrible break in your life. It really is. But at least we had a bloody good reason for being in uniform. Unlike, I don't think a single conflict since the Second World War has been an honourable one, worth fighting in. I think they've all been wars in defence of empire, our reluctance to let the empire go. We've been fighting retreating from the empire, but having to fight all the way, right up to Ireland. We didn't get out of Ireland, did we, voluntarily? Northern Ireland. We got out because of this ruthless, bloody fight that the IRA put up. That's what brought us out of Northern Ireland. And I see that pattern right the way through from 1945 onward. The Second World War was an honourable war that had to be fought. It's a war of survival. Well, that's my summing up.
What was the morale like among those recruits?
Morale, I think There's a lot of cynicism always in the army. It's difficult to see through that to how people actually feel, you know. We're so good at hiding ourselves, aren't we? I lived with men. I lived with the same men for, I suppose, some of the guys who I'd been with in Watford and Nottingham ended up with me in Cairo in 1942. And so I was with them in 42, 43, 44, to the end of the war. I mean, some of us lived together for 4 years, you know. Always, when we were in Italy anyway, it was a fear of death, not coming back. And this is an enormous binding of people together. No matter how different you are in outlook and philosophy or whatever, you're comrades in a war. It's something very special, that. I mean, I suppose all veterans say that. It's why a lot of them say, oh, the best years of my life. Which is an exaggeration, but I see what they mean.
What did you get in the way of free time and leave during the basic training?
Yes, free time. Well, once or twice I took that illegally and paid the price. Without permission, shall I say, without army permission. We got leave, I suppose we got leave about, say, a week. I don't know, it's... I can't really remember. We did get the odd leave, shall we say. It may have been only a few days. Perhaps every 3 months. I don't really, can't be factual about that, except to say that we did have leave occasionally. And I mean, that was valuable. It was just to take the uniform off and get up in the morning when you liked, and with me by the home by the sea, I'd go off and do a lot of swimming. And of course, you met Mum and Dad and your brother, although he was called up just a year or two later. I suppose, in wartime, it was adequate. You know, I think authorities did what they could to. I knew they didn't want too rebellious an army out there, and the occasional leave home was essential, I think, for morale, absolutely, not just for the soldier, but of course there for their families, especially the married ones, who I always felt sorry for, and really did. It's easier for us single guys, single blokes. So there, but of course it wasn't so adequate that you didn't want a bit more leave. And I remember once I thought, oh, to hell with it, I'm going home this weekend. I didn't. There were no duties. This was from Watford, I think. And I took a train to Victoria and to Brighton. And of course at Brighton station, a red cap approached me, pass please. And I didn't have one, so he took tickers, and he said, okay, mate, off you go, and he let me, so I mean, he reported me, but he let me go on home, which I thought was rather nice of him, and so I had an unofficial weekend. I went back, and I was brought before my officer, of course, and I had some mild punishment, I think the officers looked and weren't surprised when it happened occasionally. I wasn't punished badly. I probably had to report to the cookhouse and do some spud beating or something stupid like that. So I don't think that happened more than once or twice.